Mr. Hunter, reel three.
Yeah, we were taught how to dig trenches and how to dig and build bunkers, and more or less in battle conditions, how to survive, where to look and where to go, trekking across the mountains and down valleys and through springs and rivers, and this literally under fire all the time. In fact, it was so realistic, we actually had three blokes who were wounded on the exercise. Right? Because it was so, what should I say, realistic, simulated warfare.
Was this under the Americans or the British?
It was under the British. Mad Colonel Marsden, they called him. He just had a pair of pumps with tennis shoes on, an old baggy pair of trousers, and a khaki jumper, no hat, no pips on his shoulder, and a great big walking stick. And he was actually mad. He was actually fine. He put the whole MT out on the rest because his jeep wouldn't start one more. He was that type of person. And we'd done 14 days on this course, and we all lined up when we'd finished. And he says, and all the lorries were standing there, every paper bag. And he says, if I send you boys to Korea, half of you will be dead in the first fortnight. He says, because you are absolutely useless, you're a shower. And he says, you can do another 14 days. And we had to do another 14 days on this course. And do it all again. Right. At the end of that 14 days, he says, one or two of you might survive now. He says, I'm quite confident that you'll make out all right. He says, you can go now. And we had to go right back to the JIB camp. And after being at the JIB camp a few more days, a couple of weeks, it suddenly went up on the notice board all these names that were being transferred to the Black Watch. So we're looking on the board and my name was down there.
Is this the 1st Battalion of the Black Watch?
Pardon?
1st Battalion.
Yeah, 1st Battalion of the Black Watch. We're being transferred to the 1st Battalion of the Black Watch. And we'll be going to Korea, and we'll be boarding the boat the next morning. So we went and got all our gear together, and packed all our gear up. Now, here's a funny thing. When we got down to the waterfront, to the harbour, and we got on this boat, about 300 of us. No more, about 300. Men. So the boat was, say, twice the size of a trawler, a little bit bigger than a trawler, and it had a Chinese crew, and it was a Chinese boat called the H.T. Po Yang. I made a note of looking at that, and I thought, well, that's a funny name, a boat, Po Yang. And when I was on the boat, I see this, the seamen on the decks and the cooks in the galley. And I said, you're all Chinese? He said, yeah, we're all Chinese. I said, well, that's great, that is it. Going to Korea on a Chinese boat with a Chinese crew to fight Chinese. I said, how do they make that out then? And he just shrugged his shoulders. He said, well, we don't know how we say. We just take men over to the other side. Now, that is ironic to me, how the Chinese can charter a boat to the British government. And I noticed in one of our books that came from the BKVA, the British Korean Veteran Association, that somebody challenged the government over there and they denied that they hired the H.C. Po Yang, and I know they did because I sailed in it. And when I got to Korea, there was an American band on the quay, and as we got off this boat, they were playing If I knew you were coming, I'd have baked a cake. Yeah.
This is
a mass band.
Is this at Pusan?
No, yeah, Pusan. Yeah. If I knew you were coming, I'd have baked a cake. Yeah. And, well, we got off the HD Paul Yang. And we got on a train. And, we trundled on this train. I was, didn't go very fast. We're up to Incheon. That's halfway up to there, Incheon, must be, because that was about a day and a night, and well into the next day, this train was on. Wooden seats. Oh, it's terrible.
Which month is this that you arrived in Korea, do you know?
No. It was somewhere in May.
Don't worry too much, just to give me an idea, that's enough.
I know it's somewhere in May, but I don't think, at that time, you couldn't go into action until you were 19 anyway. And that was near my 19th birthday. And we trundled up on that train, and all we could see out of the left and right of the windows was devastated vehicles, guns, equipment. Devastated villages and towns. Never seen nothing like it. Everything was flat as a pancake. Even when we got to Pusan, you know, and Incheon, rather. We got as far as Incheon, and got out of this railway station, and it was absolutely flat. Even the railway station was flat, and they just cleared the rubble off the railway lines so the train could still run on it. And we paired the lines, obviously. And we got off there, and then got in army trucks. Because it was all lovely flat country, going up there. And of course, the lorries then took us from there. We then went up into the mountains. It started to get hilly as it got to the mountains. And we were about 6 miles behind the front line, eh? And we set up camp for the 1st Battalion Black Watch, which was to make a camp to house somewhere in the region of 1,400 men. So we're putting up all these type tents with got half wooden sides, yeah, with a bell tent over the top of that. And we set up the camp and done all the bits and pieces, dug the latrines, fixed the cookhouses up, built the natty, places like that, and the MT yard and the buildings, dug the pits for them, repaired the vehicles, and lined them with half tree trunks and what have you. And once we'd done that, we had a bit of spare time on our hands, we had a nice, cushy little week. Waiting for the 1st Battalion to arrive. We were invited to the American camp down the road. They had a movie on this particular night. And anyone went to go.
A what?
A movie. Film shot. Yeah? Anyone went to come down to American camp to see the movie, you're welcome. There'll be lorries coming up. Something such a time to go. Anyway, I kind of run out of the tent and jumped up on the power board of the lorry to get on. And Daisy Albright and Danny Ickey and all the boys were on that particular lorry, you see. And one of them took my hat off and threw it. So I had to drop off the power board and run and get my hat, and the lorry took off without me. So I got on the next lorry. And when we'd been gone a little while, we come round this bend, and the lorry I went to get on had turned over. And Daisy Albright got pinned under the tailboard and dropped on her legs and smashed both her legs. So we got them actually physically lifted the lorry up and got her note. And obviously they went away in an ambulance and never did see Daisy for a while after that. She was sent to hospital. Never did get to the morgue that night, obviously, with all that turmoil, went back to camp. And Daisy does come into it at the end of the story. Then the 1st Battalion arrived. There was a lot of fighting. Scotchmen didn't like the Englishmen. They were Saxonics. And they didn't want to know us. She had no right to be in a Scotch regiment. And all that old rubbish. And they had fight after fight in there. And eventually, we were put into the front line, our first division in the front line. And then things started to alter then. They didn't care whether you were Scotch, Swahili, or whatever you wanted to be, as long as they had somebody with them. Anyway, we got on this first position. We're about 1,400 yards from the Chinese position, with a big valley in the front. I don't know. Maybe it was a yellow one. It was at the end of the river. I can't remember now. I know it was a river now. And this position we were in, there was grass and shrubs everywhere. And we were all peeping over the top of the trench and sitting down below and standing to it night, all night. Rolls of barbed wire in front. Six men going out at night on a listen patrol down the bottom of the hill to listen for anything that's mass traffic coming through. They come back and warn everybody there's an attack coming in the water. Went on. Week went by. Never had a shell or more. Grass was growing, flowers were growing, birds were singing, sun was shining. Started leaning on the trenches, looking over the top like this. Time went by. The boys got out of the trenches and started walking about on top of the trench. Still nothing happened.
This is the front line.
This is the front line.
Whereabouts?
I think there was a war on.
Whereabouts was this?
This was, I think it was 210, but the hills never had. Some hills had names. But other hills, you use the number, what they put on the map is the height. Yeah? It was either 210 or 201. So as we were walking about the position, everybody got more confident. Nobody said China, and nobody had a shot fired, not a shell, not a mortar. Everybody started walking about, sitting up on top of the trenches, reading, writing, sunning themselves, and all the time the Chinese were watching and just seeing how far and how brave we were getting. And then they started sending stuff over, mortars and 25 pounders and stuff like that. And the people were scared into the trenches, into the bunkers, because the bunkers were built about 8 feet square with tree trunks on the top, and then sandbags on the top of that, and then earth and shrubs on the top of that. And they'd take a 25 pounder, the trees used to give. And there used to be dust, full of dust, used to fall down on it, but they were quite safe in the bunker. And they'd shell periodically, probably one every half hour or one every hour, however they felt. Just to keep you awake. Same at night. When you stand to at night. And occasionally you, as it got daybreak the next morning, you'd have propaganda leaflets hanging on the barbed wire. Don't risk your life for Yankee dollars, and throw down your arms and come over to the People's Republic Army and things like that. They'd sneak up at nights and hang these pamphlets about the place.
Did they have any effect?
Yeah. desk on Sunday, but I can't think where I put them. They're written on moist paper. Yeah, about 8 inches long, about 6 inches wide. Had a picture of a man in a wheelchair, and had it written in Chinese and in English. Don't wish your life for Yankee dollars, things like that. This could happen to you. That type of thing. Anyway, got used to being under fire. It was a bit terrifying, and the hardest thing is getting out when you're being shelled, because anything can happen. If you've got to get out in the trenches, once you're in a bunker, that's the hardest thing to do. Because you know you're safe in the bunker and you're vulnerable in the trenches. But you have to get out. And you have to bring yourself to it. And that's a terrifying thing about it. But apart from that, we had a listening post down in front of the position in a windy path all the way down. And it was my turn on the listening post. And we're going down there. And it was just getting dark. Light was just fading. And we're under canopies of trees and shrubs. Down the front of the hill. Down a windy path. Come to a bend in the path like that. And just as we got to the bend in the path, the bloke in front of me stopped. And his back of his edge of his chin hat hit me right between the eyes. I could always shout, and I said, "What the hell are you doing?" And when I looked up, there was a Chinese patrol coming towards us, and we weren't more than 8 feet apart. We turned around that way, and the Chinese turned around that way. That was a shot fired. It was so quick. And you didn't realise what had happened. And it actually happened. And we went back, down the path, round the bend, rifles at the ready, all cocked and ready to go, but they'd gone. They were long away. But the funny thing about it was, I thought about it afterwards and I told our son, how did that Chinese patrol get from the Chinese trenches 1400 yards away to meet us on a track coming down the front of our positions in that short time? They didn't, did they? They had patrols living out in no man's land all day long and all night long, and they were dug into the hillsides and river banks and in the shrubs, and they were hidden there all day and all night. That's how they got there so quick. And, we never did see any more on that position. We've done our first term on that position, and that I think was done deliberately because it was a soft position. There was grass and shrubs everywhere. They took us out of that one onto another one called the Hackle. And that was a little bit worse. And it was a Hackle, I believe. We went on a fighting party. They wanted a prisoner. And we had an officer with a smacking book. His name was Rennie Taylor. And we got in a position where they said that the Chinese had a listening post, and the idea was to give the boys covering fire on these two brain guns while they went in to get a prisoner. Well, me and this other guy opened up with these brain guns, and we were in paddy fields, and the rice had gone to seed, and they were like weeds. So I had the mountain of machine gun on the look who bent over in front of me to keep clear so I could give the boys cover and fire with a machine gun, you see. And that's how I had to fire it. Swept the fire that way, and the boys went in. Because the Chinese must have heard us coming anyway. And there was nobody there. By the time we all got back to the paddy field, the officer said, well, they know we're here now. He says, they're going to come and look at it. And what we better do now is call a DF task down, the artillery, and then we can pull out. Because there's 14 of us. There's no way for 14 men in 6 inches of water get away without making a noise. So he gets on the blow on it. Ted Gould was a radio operator, because he was a press runner. He got on the radio on Ted's back and he called for a DF task. And he got the map out and I see him looking at the map and he took a map reference. Now whether there was a fault in that map or whether he made a mistake, a dreadful mistake, I do not know. When the artillery pull a barrage up, they get so many bombs in the air before the first one hit the ground. And that lot fell amongst us. There was three hills in front of us, four hills, Matthew, Mark, Luke and John. There was one higher than the other, all the way up there. They called it Matthew, Mark, Luke and John. And that's where then shells should have dropped. And whether there was a fault in the map, between the artillery map and our map, or whether that officer made a dreadful mistake, I do not know. But the whole lot fell in this paddy field where we were laying. And I was laying down there in 6 inches of the water, trying to keep my map out of the water, and all these shells dropped amongst us. And that shrapnel was cutting the rice down. It was cutting the reeds. Actually, you could hear it and feel it. And when it finished and died away, there was one bloke hit, and that was a poor officer who pulled the past there. Had his leg blown away at the top. The whole 14 men had scattered. There was five. There was Ted Gould, the radio operator, Alan Sandland, myself, and two more. I can't remember who they were. And I remember I was the smallest one amongst them. And this officer weighed about 14 stone. And we couldn't stop the bleeding. I took my shirt off and we stuck my shirt in his leg and made it all up. And we carried him all the way back through these paddy fields and through these minefields. And when we got back to this position, the bottom of our position, Ted managed to get the radio to work. It hadn't been working all the time we'd been here, and the poor officer was getting bigger. And we got right to the bottom of our own positions. We couldn't go up because the officer brought us down these positions, and there were booby traps. So we needed somebody to come down from the our position to show us a way back through the booby traps. And they sent two sergeants down. By the time they got there, the officer had died. But we still carried him all the way up the hill. We took him back with us. And all the other men, the 14 men, well, had scared, were all eventually accounted for. Eventually wound up back in their own positions. Because when you're out on patrol at night, you could tell British positions and the Rock Army and the Australians and the Americans. You could tell what the Americans, where the Americans were, because everybody was all smoking and big cigar smokes. You could see the little glows coming from the trenches where they're smoking at night in the trenches. That was the Yanks. And anyway, we got the officer back and we couldn't carry all the gear. And I got threatened by the sergeant. He said, where's the 2 inch more? I said, well, I dumped it. He said, dumped it? I said, yeah, I disarmed it and I dumped it. I said, I couldn't carry it. I was carrying five rifles, a Bren gun, all the ammo, and the other four men were carrying the officer. He said, well, you're wind up on us. I was called Marshall for dumping that 2 inch more. I said, I'm talking about it. But I never heard no more about it. I never went on a fortnight. But I kicked on my own to the doctor to enter. And the boss. But I mean, I put it in, it was in a big pool of water. And I threw the working parts one way and dumped them. What's that now? And then dumped the bomb somewhere else. Anyway, that was our first taste of action. Never say a China. It wasn't to be on that position either. Because then we were pulled off there and we went behind the lines. Another section behind the lines where you trained, had a bit of free time as well, swimming, in the rivers and stuff like that. I can remember swimming one day with Alan, and an American GI was swept down the river, and Alan went and dived in and got him out. I can't remember whether he survived or not. I know they took him away, but whether he survived or not, we don't know. And then we went, our next position was called the hook. And we were told when we took the hook over, or when we take the hook over, that the main road to Seoul comes through the hook, and no way must you pull off the hook. The hook must be held, otherwise the Chinese would bring their tanks up on the roads. So I didn't think nothing of it at the time. And this particular night, the corporals and the sergeants went up with the Americans to see the position where they'd want to put the guards. And George Overy, who lived in Lowestoft, who I joined up with, he was a corporal, he went with them. And they got a bunch of 60mm bullets dropped in amongst them when he was up there. And that's how George lost his life. I think that when we sorted out the bits and pieces from the Americans and the British, I think George, if I can remember rightly, he was in a carnation, wooden carnation milk box. Remember carnation milk tins?
Yes.
We used to get a little wooden box. Here's a kind of wooden box. I think there's 4 dozen in a box. And that was George in there. Put them in a box. What did they call him? His mum used to come around mine when they came home. But I used to avoid it. Get out of the way. Anyway.
Why did you avoid her?
I didn't like to see what I know how he died. And I couldn't tell her that.
Why could you not tell her?
No. All I told my mother to tell her was that George didn't feel a thing. No, I couldn't tell her things like that. So, kind of reason I just couldn't face her. But anyway, once we got up onto this position, you'd never see nothing like it in your life. There wasn't a blade of grass anywhere. Not a shrub, a weed, nothing. It looked as if somebody made a mountain out of earth. And I said to him,